The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there, welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of all the best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, the Honourable Harry Herbert reminisced about growing up in the magnificent surroundings of Highclere Castle, the real-life Downton Abbey, and he explained how its upkeep is maintained through Elton John concerts, groundbreaking cricket matches, and cups of tea and potted plants. Ahead of World Narcolepsy Day, young mum Christine Beck told me about living with this debilitating condition that is not widely spoken of, but affects her day-to-day life dramatically, from her ability to work to minding her own children. Multi-million selling author Cecilia Ahern joined me 3 weeks ahead of the newest arrival to the family to discuss life, death and Postscript, the long-awaited sequel to P.S. I Love You. And X Factor presenter Dermot O'Leary and I had a great chat about, amongst many things, his children's books, which star Toto the Ninja Cat. The latest installment is called Toto the Ninja Cat and the Superstar Catastrophe, and it's perfectly hysterical. And after reading it, you'll really be feline good. It's a brilliant work of literature. Okay, that's enough. You get the idea. Read the book. That's it for this week. Hope you enjoy it. Until next time, thank you for listening. Well, I've been talking about it this morning. It's one of the most recognisable castles on the television, now on the big screen, the magnificent mansion, castle, whatever you want to call it. It's Highclere Castle is the official title. More than just a set for Downton Abbey, it was once the place where the Honourable Harry Herbert joins, lived and has lived and is on the ground still. Harry, good morning to you.
Morning, Ryan. How are you?
Very nice to talk to you. I believe you haven't seen the film, is that right?
I'm ashamed to say I haven't. No, I was out in Kentucky buying horses and came back, and I just haven't had a chance to see it yet, but obviously I will and look forward to it hugely.
Well, it's a great Downton excuse. I was in Kentucky buying horses, and we'll have to accept that as a given. I was intrigued to learn that about your grandfather, who we would have read about in the history books back in the 80s. Tell me about the 5th Earl of Carnarvon.
Well, yeah, that was the great-grandfather, actually.
Great-grandfather, excuse me.
Yeah, great-grandfather. Well, he was like the sort of Indiana Jones of his day, and he drove one of the first cars, and he was an early photographer, and he crashed his car going very, very slowly, as obviously he would have done in those days.
Yeah.
And the drama of it all, he went to see his doctor, and his doctor dispatched him to Egypt to recuperate in the dry heat there.
Yeah.
And that's where he met the great Egyptologist Howard Carter.
Yes.
And this sort of quest to find the tomb of King Tut began. And eventually he did it. Took him a few years, but he found it in the end with Carter's help, obviously.
So they uncovered the tomb of Tutankhamun, and that's quite the legacy, historically at least, for the family.
It was amazing, obviously, at the time, and the headlines and all the papers, you know, were Tomb of King Tut discovered, when will curse strike? And he duly cut himself shaving, a little mosquito bite, got septicemia, and he died very shortly thereafter. And when he died, all the lights went out in Cairo, and his little terrier dog that had been with him on all of his expeditions howled and howled and died at exactly the same time, which was pretty spooky, although apparently the lights always used to go out in Cairo. But anyway, it was still pretty spooky stuff.
Well, it's a delicious end. Excuse the, you know, to be facetious about your great grandfather, but it is a kind of delightful end if you would believe in that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it was quite, you know, my grandfather, who then took over, you know, became the 6th Earl of Carnarvon, and he wouldn't have the name Tutankhamun spoken in the castle. He was, you know, scared to death of being zapped by the curse as well. And one of the great moments actually came when he died, and my father took over, and we were doing there was an inventory of the castle being done, and we were standing around there as a guy from Sotheby's, and my brother and myself and my father, and in the corner, the great Robert Taylor, who was the equivalent of Carson. He was my dad's and grandfather's butler. And my father said, well, thank goodness that's all over with. And there was a sort of pregnant pause before Robert Taylor said, it is everything apart from the Egyptian stuff, my lord. And there was just one of those great moments, and we all sort of stared at Robert Taylor. And my father said, good God, Robert, what are you talking about? And he took us on that very slow, leisurely butler-like walk to this amazing sort of hidden cabinets, if you like, between two big rooms, which had he had discovered these treasures about 30 years before, and he hadn't even told his wife. He just kept it quiet because he knew that my grandfather would either destroy them or sell them or do something awful. And there they were. And, of course, where there are some treasures, we were convinced there had to be more. So we went winging around the castle, banging on doors and hoping there would be other hidden cabinets, which there weren't, but there were lots of other various Egyptian artifacts in clothing and in the back of safes and all sorts of places. So it really was a very exciting time. And of course, now there is the Egyptian exhibition in the cellars, which anyone can go and see if you go to Highclere.
Right. So Highclere, as you mentioned it, being the original, I believe, for Downton Abbey, is, although even in the film, the shots from the sky, it just looks so magnificent. Can you give us an indication, Harry, of, you know, the logistics of the place in terms of size, bedrooms? I mean, it just looks enormous, but what have you got for us?
It's a really interesting building. I mean, it is. It's very big, but it's also, you know, it's got a great feel to it, great atmosphere to it. It's a lot cozier than you'd think it would be.
Yes.
And hopefully everyone who goes there would think that. It's, I mean, originally it was the summer palace for the bishops of Winchester way back in sort of 900 or so.
they didn't slum it, did they?
I know, way back when. And then it became Elizabethan house, and then a beautiful Georgian house, and then the Victorians came along. It's only the Victorians did. They didn't, you know, didn't need planning permission from Basingstoke and Dean Borough Council. They thought, we need to castellate this place. And so Sir Charles Barry, the great architect, was who designed the Houses of Parliament. He was brought in to basically reface the Georgian house in bar stone and put those magnificent turrets and you know, the big centrepiece.
Yes, I can see the connection as you say it. Yeah,
it looks very similar to the House of Parliament, but because a lot of the rooms are Georgian and it just works as a house. And you know, as a kid, we used to go up there a lot. My brother, my sister, and I. My grandfather was alive, and he was a great eccentric. He wasn't in any way like Lord Grantham, but he was nonetheless a great person to be around. And you know, we used to spend a lot of time up there. And as I say, Robert Taylor, the great butler, the Carson equivalent.
Yes.
He ruled it with a rod of iron. I think he was the only person my grandfather used to listen to. But it was a wonderful place. And then when eventually it was opened to the public and in the various events there, and it immediately became, you know, a very popular spot, and all sorts of movies and TV shows. Jeeves and Wooster was made there.
How was it?
And then along came Junior Fellows and Downton Abbey, and it sort of transformed everything as I say, it was my brother and sister-in-law who run the castle. But that is the sort of gift from God, if you like, if you have a stately home and you've got to keep the roof on and there's huge costs involved in, you know, in repair the whole time, then obviously Downton Abbey was the absolute sort of jackpot.
And are there really 300 bedrooms?
No, there's not 300 bedrooms. There may be 300 rooms, not 300 bedrooms.
So you've got, you're on 600 acres?
No, it'd be more than that. It'd be more than that. It'd probably be about 5,000 acres.
Good Lord.
With the park and the, you know, everything included. And my grandfather's Dave and father's Dave, a sort of stud farm, and the park and the agricultural farm. And, you know, like all those bases, it was a sort of community in itself, really. Everybody living and working in around the, you know, on the place. And growing up, I grew up nearby, my sister and brother and I, in a sort of what they call a folly house, which was a beautiful house on a lake, about half a mile, two quarters of a mile away from the castle. But you know, everyone was very close, and in fact, Bates could have been so bizarre, because he could have been my dad's butler, you know, that I grew up with in the house. I mean, much more that sort of character, more slightly sort of more gentle than, you know, a different sort of person to Carson.
Yes,
but as I say, you know, it was an amazing place, beautiful place to grow up around, and the Capability Brand Design Park, and very lucky to. You know, Clodagh and I live in a about half a mile or so from the castle in our own little patch of Highclere, but it's not as big as Downton.
No, I can imagine.
But it is a very beautiful spot.
Clodagh is Clodagh McKenna, who was sitting across from me here a few months ago. She's very well known in the cooking world, as it were, and so you're together. How did you guys meet, as a matter of interest? I think she might have mentioned it to us. Was it dinner?
We met at a boardroom dinner in Fortnum & Mason.
It was a
lunch, actually, yeah. And absolutely, it was one of those fantastic moments, sort of sliding door moments. She could have been at the end of the table and, you know, I could have been at the other end, but we were next door to one another and have been really happy together. And, you know, what's so exciting is that whole food world that she's involved in, getting to know that and see her finish her sixth book, Lotus Suppers, and now, you know, what we're doing together at Broadspear, bringing back an 18th century sort of broken down walled garden, and, you know, with Clodagh's incredible energy and, you know, and enthusiasm, we've brought this beautiful place back together. And we hosted our first event, which you'll be pleased to hear,
yes.
Brian, was Tourism Ireland, so
yeah.
Taste the Island.
Oh, yeah, so they're doing a big push on Taste the Island. You did that, that's on the grounds of Highclere, is it, Harry?
We did, yeah, in our place, exactly, at Broadspear.
Really?
We did that, and it really was spectacular. It was fantastic, about over 50 writers and influencers and bloggers, and we had it in this beautiful pergola, all the produce from Ireland, Carlingford oysters and Glendalough gin and all sorts of wonderful things. And, of course, Clodagh brought it all together, and it was a great success. And it's just very exciting. You know, when
sure.
some of these old places like Highclere, they just, you know, they need, you know, when there's sort of real love and attention brought into them, which hasn't been there for years for whatever reason, it's incredible bringing it back. And now with bees and all sorts of chickens and God knows what else, we're going to be fully sustainable within a few months.
So watching the movie and looking at the house, the castle, whatever you want to call it, but watching the seeing the enormity of it, I find myself going, how utterly impractical it looks as a home. And you're keen to say and that it's cosy. How can something be so sprawling and so palatial and magnificent be in any way homely?
I think it's probably you know, the people who make it, because it's the, you know, obviously you've got, if there's sort of two of you, they'd be rattling around, but obviously with the team and the house and the fact that the house you know, is used so much, from private events to obviously the entertaining that my brother and sister-in-law would be doing, it really comes alive. And when we first opened it to the public, which would be back in about 1989, I mean, it was a great moment. My father, who was sort of hugely enthusiastic about the whole thing, and we did have the fortunate PR sort of scoop of having the hidden treasure, which genuinely was a coincidence, happened at the time we opened.
A fortunate coincidence, yes.
But it did bring in a large number of people, and everybody said the same thing. Mm. It looks this vast building from the outside, but actually when you get inside it, it feels much warmer. Mm. It's not cold. It's, you know, it's everything. All the paintings are there, and the furniture is all in position. Like it, you know, you don't feel like you're behind ropes and you're not in empty rooms, like sadly so many of these big houses are. So I think it's all of the above. I mean, it's the books in the library. It's the, you know, it's the beautiful paintings, the sofas, and I think it's a friendly house.
I'm thinking of the great houses that, you know, I think no matter whether you're in a flat or a terraced house or whatever it might be, the world is divided into people live in either houses or homes, regardless of size.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that house in Remains of the Day or Brideshead you visited, they look as cold as the people who inhabited them, and Downton brings you something warmer.
It's such a good point, and I think if you take, you know, Downton again, you take all of those characters, those wonderful characters, and Maggie Smith and Hugh Bonneville and Lady Mary and the whole, you know, all of them, and the butlers and the maids and the cook, you know, those characters all existed in my childhood when my grandfather was alive. Obviously, then things are a bit different thereafter.
Yes.
But they all existed, and so it's really fascinating when that show, you know, first came on board. And you described it, I think, earlier, as we have such a good expression, a cinematic hug.
Yeah.
On every Sunday evening, it was a sort of tele hug.
That's
think.
Right. Yeah, like Antiques Roadshow for some people.
Exactly.
As well. In the same zone. Yeah.
It so was, and I think it's the people as much as the place and the place, those people, and the, you know, it all sort of works together. And it's you know, it is fantastic to see it, you know, brought to life again in the, you know, through Downton, brought, you know, that sort of, it's very accurate. Is you know, people often ask me, oh, is it really like that, or was it really like that? And the answer is very, very similar. I can't say all of the sort of goings on really happened, obviously, but you can bet they probably did, because, you know, there are so many, the upstairs, downstairs bit is you know, they would have had over 30, 40 people living in the house at the time, you know, back in the 1900s, early 1900s.
Yeah, of course. And there was another thing, and I'm not a big fan of retrospectively applying today's mores on another time's, you know, realities. But I often wonder, and you know, when you talk about the butler and so on, Robert Taylor or whatever, did you ever, maybe you, because generationally it's different to the Downton we see, was it ever embarrassing to have an upstairs, downstairs situation? Do you ever kind of feel, God, it's a bit embarrassing that they polish the shoes, that they deliver the food, that they, these are, you know, good people, but have to be so subservient? I mean, it's a class thing in Britain and Ireland, it's kind of different, but did you ever look at it that way, or were you just to the manor born, literally? And this isn't pejorative, Harry. You know, I was just curious about generations.
I didn't, Ron. I mean, I never felt that. I don't think we ever felt that way, because genuinely, it was a very happy environment. You know, my mates were, you know, a housekeeper's son and the keeper's son, and, you know, I spent my summers, you know, with their kids and vice versa. We were very much all in together, and I never ever looked at any of the team that worked for my father or grandfather as anything other than friends.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I remember heading off to back to Kentucky when I was about 20, 21 or 19, that sort of age. I went to live in America and get stuck into the horse business. Mm-hmm. And I remember sort of as I departed, it was wonderful seeing the folks sort of waving goodbye, like this sort of like he may never return. And you had the butler and the maid and the lovely people. So I never thought that. And I'd hate to think that they would have thought anything different as well.
Yes.
Because they were, you know, they were very much part of the family. That's not trying to be corny, or, you know, they were. And so the answer, very long-winded answer.
No. It gives us an insight into how it all works in many regards. And there was a moment at the end of the film when Maggie Smith is kind of, she's talking about essentially the house and the future of the house. And it's a conversation, no doubt, that many of the people who own the big houses down through the years had to have, which is, we don't have the money, we don't have the means, but we have this enormous house. What do we do? And in terms of about the class barriers were starting to break down, but that's not really where I'm getting at. Really, it was just the fact that you had to eventually have to open it up to the public and let strangers come in and traipse through what is essentially your home, but for a price, come and see a Britain that's dying or nearly dead.
Yeah, I absolutely get that. I mean, just to give you an idea, when I was when my grandfather was dying, and he was in a nursing home in Highclere, very sort of, you know, close by in the village, and I think everyone else was away apart from myself, and I got the call from the nursing home saying, you know, Miss Harry, your grandfather's gravely, and I understand that you're the only family member around. So I thought, oh, great, I'll be right there, thinking, oh, cool, you know, this is not going to be very easy. And as I was passing Robert Taylor, the butler's house, his little cottage, I thought, well, I'll knock on the door and just see if he's here, and, you know, hope that he'll come with me. And Robert was painting, you know, he was doing some sort of, you know, DIY stuff, and he had his overalls on. I was actually shocked to see a member of the family while he had all his paint splattered overalls. So I explained the situation, and he said, of course I'll come, Mr. Harry, of course I'll come. And in 2 seconds, he was changed and into his immaculate, tails and butler's kit. And we drove on down to the nursing home.
Yes.
And it was one of the most touching things I'll ever see in my life, where, you know, again, Robert Taylor taking control, walked in there, and there's my grandfather sort of on death's door in his bed. And he went straight up to the bed, and he sat down on the bed, and he took my grandfather's hand, and he said, my lord, Robert here, and Mr. Harry. And we just, the two of us, would like to know that you have nothing to worry about whatsoever. We are here with you. And it was really sort of teary stuff.
Yes,
but that showed the relationship between the two. And it was very close, you know. And likewise, when my father took over, again, the same thing, a very, very close relationship. But I remember when, you know, we did first open to the public, and my father, I mean, he was wonderful, but he thought he could keep the roof on by selling potted plants and cups of coffee and tea. And it was very, I mean, it was hysterical. Every meeting we had would start with, you know, we've had a fantastic week. We've sold 25 potted plants and a record 100 cups of tea. Well done, everybody.
Yeah. The roof is caving in, but the tea is selling well.
But the tea is selling really well. And then, of course, things changed and we got, the events began to happen and we were one of the first to get a wedding license and we had the first game of cricket, the first South Africa, the first game out of apartheid was at Highclere. I mean, it was the most phenomenal event, and things like that started happening. And what that does is it breathes a whole new life back into the estate and to everyone working there. And then you do see that room is restored. My dad said the drawing room was restored, the dining room restored, paintings are relit and cleaned.
Yes.
And
you're keeping history alive. That's my feeling about it. That this is really important.
Absolutely. My dad always said, those in charge, we're just custodians, we're caretakers, and on to the next generation, and hopefully, the generation after that. But it's not easy. I mean, I don't, my brother and sister-in-law, they've worked very hard to make it all happen. But of course, Downton Abbey is the most wonderful thing to enable. Yeah, roof to be redone and to do all sorts of other things, extend the garden and put an arboretum in, all sorts of other things. So it's fantastic.
But there was only so much pots of tea would have done to go towards to defraying the costs.
When we had the great, I'll never forget the meeting when we'd finished the cricket, the South African cricket, and we'd had an Elton John concert. It had been the most amazing month where the place was sort of humming. This was long before Downton Abbey.
Sure.
And my father, started the sort of meeting at the end of that month, or the beginning of the next month with, it's obviously been a very successful month. Well done, everybody. Particularly with the hanging baskets, which have had a fantastic time. We thought, I can't believe it. We're talking hundreds of thousands of pounds of these other events, and we're still talking about hanging baskets.
He was determined. Harry,
it was his bag.
Yeah, I tell you what, you sold it to me. I'm definitely going to get over for a look some afternoon. And
you must.
Yeah, I really must. But it's been a real pleasure to talk to you, and thank you so much. The best to Clodagh, incidentally. And thank you for your time this morning. Real pleasure.
Well, my pleasure. And I know Clodagh sends very much her best to you, Ryan.
Thanks very much. All the best. We'll talk to you again soon, Harry. Thank you very much, Harry Herbert, who is part of the family that own the real-life Downton Abbey, that is Highclere Castle. What a gentleman. I really enjoyed chatting to him and getting that insight into that world. And the movie itself, I thought the reviews were pretty mealy-mouthed and largely... unfair. I thought the movie was better than the reviews that it was getting. And certainly... The message I was getting from people on Instagram was that they really enjoyed it. So, that's an honest-to-goodness take on that film. And, Harry Herbert joining us on the line there from the UK. Now, we do have another guest to bring to your attention, and we will get to this superstar after this. At 9:35, right, okay, 51551 is the text number. You can email ryan@rte.ie. Christine Beck, young mum of two, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
And thanks for coming in to see us today.
Thanks for having me.
Did your story that you're going to tell us this morning all begin last April, is that right?
Yeah.
So it's quite fresh.
Like the tail end of April, around Easter.
What triggered the story? What made you decide there's something up here? What was happening in your life?
So I was just sleeping a lot, which was very unusual. I would sleep 14 hours a night, wake up, go downstairs, and I'd be asleep on the couch again. Could not keep myself awake whatsoever. So I thought that was a bit weird. And I had a GP appointment anyway, just to go in and get a smear. And I kind of said to the GP, I was like, this is very weird, my sleeping. And not only that, but I was feeling like the room would kind of shift, like my knees would give out. kind of similar to what I thought was vertigo.
Okay.
So she said, right, what we'll do is we'll do blood tests. It's probably a little virus that could pass, but we'll just test for everything and we'll see where we are in a week. So I was like, that's fine.
Makes sense. Yeah. And you kind of relax when you know something's been done.
And I had, like, sinusitis then a couple of months ago. I was like, it's probably something, you know, just still in my system. So I was like, that's fine, let's do that. Mm-hmm. We done the blood tests on the Thursday. And then by the weekend, what was going from my knees buckling progressed to me falling. I had absolutely no control of my muscles. My muscles would just go into paralysis and I'd fall, or my speech would slur. I couldn't hold my head up. I couldn't hold a knife and fork at dinner. I couldn't hold drinks. I was spilling them. Like, it happened so very fast.
If I didn't know you and I was watching these things happening, what would I think was happening?
You'd think I was drunk, or even like it did look like I was like a drunk a lot of the time. Or even one time in a shopping centre, I was being served and the girl kind of said to me, my sister's epileptic too. Like, so then I was like, is it epilepsy? Like, it didn't look like epilepsy to me.
And your kids are how old?
They were 2 and 10 months at the time.
And
they're 3 and 1 now.
And their names?
Logan and Noah.
Logan and Noah.
Yeah.
So you've got the kids, mm-hmm. you got your husband, the whole world should be hunky-dory.
Perfect.
But all these things started to happen.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the blood test then. They returned. And so did you glean any information from that?
They didn't. So on the Monday, that weekend got very bad. So I was just like, I'm going back to the doctor. And she checked the bloods and she's like, some have come back and what have come back are fine, but not everything is back. We need to wait the week, because she was testing me for glandular fever, which is what she suspected, which would take a week. But then I had one of these episodes of falling in front of her. So she was like, okay, time to go down to A&E. Okay. So she wrote me a letter, sent me down, and I went down then straight from the doctors.
Right. How did that go?
So went down to A&E and was seen. And again, it was like, it's so strange. If you're not looking at it, if it's not happening at the time, it's so hard to describe what was happening.
Yes.
So the doctors were like, right, we're going to admit you. We're going to do an MMR. We're going to do a few more tests and we'll kind of see from there. So I was admitted, kept overnight. And the next day I went for an MMR. And then when you're in, I was staying in A&E. There was no beds, so I was to stay in A&E. And the doctor that happened to kind of come around the next day after my MMR, which was clear, he was a respiratory specialist and he had a special interest in sleep medicine.
Well, that was just a...
That was just the luck of the draw.
So just to pause for a moment, the MMR came back saying nothing's wrong.
Nothing's wrong. All clear.
It's a total mystery. So now we're the doctor's doing the rounds, and did he have other doctors, young doctors with him?
He did, yeah. And it was like literally so lucky that he had a special interest in sleep medicine.
So he stops and says, what's your story?
Yeah, so he handed me his phone and he said, do that test there. And I now know that was the Epworth sleep scale. Mm-hmm. And it was basically a series of questions right from 1 to 3. Would you fall asleep in this scenario? And I'd done that. And he said, I'm 98% certain that you have narcolepsy with cataplexy. I'll refer you for a sleep study. And that was the first I heard of that. And then I asked how long the sleep study would be, and I was told 14 months. So then I asked, how do you expect me to live like this for 14 months? Because I've went from being a little bit tired to not being able to stand.
Yes.
I have kids. I cannot live like this for 14 months. And I was told, well,
That's your lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So went home, Googled narcolepsy with cataplexy, and it was the first time when I read the symptoms, it was the first time I read something that I was able to say, yes, that is what it is. Mm. It was the first description I heard that resonated with me. I was like, absolutely.
You know how much doctors hate people Googling.
Do you know how much I hated being sent home with no treatment?
I bet you. And that's what I'm saying to you, is that sometimes you can Google something and it can scare the bejeepers out of you. Or in your case, it confirmed, as you saw it, what was wrong.
Yeah.
Because you were frustrated, obviously.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and it seemed to be getting worse.
And so fast.
So what did you do with the information that you...
So then in that time, I was like, I genuinely didn't know what to do. I ended up going, it then got worse. I went back to A&E.
Yes.
I said, begged, pleaded, cried. Was having multiple cataplexy attacks in A&E, and the doctor there told me, there's nothing we can do. I said, you have to treat me. Like, even if if you suspected a brain tumour, you'd still treat the headache. Like, you're telling me you're 98% certain. Like, please give me something so I can hold my child.
And I suppose they had, I'm not trying to take away from the pain that you're going through.
Yeah.
And I should say MRI scan. We both said MMR. It's, yeah, the MRI scan. Is, yeah, my mistake as well. When you have these and the doctor's saying there's nothing wrong, and you're saying, no, but I'm falling down. Mm-hmm. I can't hold my child. It must be very frustrating to try and convince them that this isn't just some random tiredness episode.
Yeah.
This is a consistent thing. So how did you eventually bring them round to your sense of urgency?
I didn't. What happened was I was sent home with the advice. I was told two things. She was like, I can call a psych team down. And I said, I'm not depressed. I don't need a psych team. I'm crying because you won't treat me. And then I was told, well, then you can go home and just take care not to fall. I was back in less than a week after falling down the stairs holding my 10-month-old.
What happened that time?
So we were walking down the stairs and I was on the second step down and I had a cataplexy attack. My right leg went behind me, got trapped in the banisters. So I continued to fall about 5 steps. I was able to hold on to Noah. Thank God he was not hurt. But my leg, I could hear that it was damaged before I even felt it. So it was just me and the kids in the house. Logan, I asked him to get me my phone and he did. So I called 999 straight away. And then I called every member of my family and my fiance and I told them, whoever's closest, get here. I'm about to pass out and I'm holding Noah. So it took about 30 minutes for the paramedics to get there and they were about to break down the door. But thankfully, Logan, he ran and he got a sweep and brush, God bless him, and he was unlatched the door so they didn't have to break it down.
A little MacGyver.
Oh my God, I didn't know he could do that. He's an absolute hero.
Yeah.
Like, he was rubbing my head, he was kissing me, he was telling me Daddy would fix it, it would be okay. He was going to get toys for Noah. Noah was struggling to get out of my arms. I was holding him so tight to not drop him. And he got toys for Noah to distract him. Like, he was unreal. And the paramedics came. It was about 40 minutes then they got me out of the banisters and brought me up to Tala Hospital. And then the next day I had surgery.
On your leg?
On my leg, yeah.
Okay. What about the narcolepsy and...
So while I was in the hospital, I was in for about 10 days.
Yeah.
While I was in the hospital, obviously it wasn't so much of a concern because I was just lying in the bed, but my orthopedic surgeon, thankfully, it was decided I was going private. I couldn't wait 14 months. The private waitlist is 10 months. So my...
It's hardly a leap, is it?
Not really. So thankfully, my orthopedic surgeon actually rang the private consultant and said, I can't discharge her. If she falls again on this leg...
Fast track.
Yeah, please do. So I was able to then get an appointment. I had a 2-month wait then.
Okay.
But I was on 24-hour bed rest. So whenever I got home, I went straight upstairs to my room and I did not leave until I had my appointment with the sleep consultant.
So how long were you in bed?
Like three months.
3 months?
In a room, on my own.
How much of the day, on a given day, were you sleeping? Were you 14 hours or more?
And narcolepsy is very weird. I fall asleep very easily.
Yeah.
But I don't have a good sleep. It's not restful and I wake a lot.
Bad dreams?
Very vivid dreams and hallucinations. Like, I will talk to people who are not there when I'm going into sleep and when I'm coming out of sleep. So it's very bizarre. I never knew what it was. I was so ignorant.
And can you or should you medicate for that? Or
so, yeah, but you need the sleep study first.
I see. So you do the sleep study and then they can say, right, well, you'll need this in the morning to wake up and this in the evening to regulate your sleep pattern, I presume.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So you take, during the day, you take like amphetamines.
Right. It's quite intense.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
to keep you going during the day. And then at night, there's a few options. There's many options and people take different things. I take Xyrem, which I take 2 doses. So the first dose is at 10 o'clock and that puts me asleep. And then 4 hours later, ping, I'm awake. I take my second dose and that puts me asleep for another 4 hours.
Good.
And it cuts out the REM cycle.
Okay.
So with narcolepsy, you're constantly in REM, so you're not getting that restorative deep sleep.
Rapid
that you
eye
need.
Movement.
Yes, yeah, constantly dreaming.
Okay. Do you, when your sleep pattern is as completely disrupted, if not destroyed, as yours, I know that if anyone listening, and all of us, if we have a terrible night's sleep, you're kind of demented for the next day because it just doesn't sit right with you. So if you're narcoleptic, What's that doing to your psychology or your head?
So basically, a person with narcolepsy would function. Like if you were to not sleep for 3 days straight, that's how we feel every day.
That's pretty rough.
Yes,
it's dark, to say the least.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And then you can, what, can you watch TV? Can you listen to, can you drive? Can you?
You can drive when your medication is under control.
Okay.
Some people can't at all. So if your medication is under control, you can. I can't watch films. It takes me like a week to watch an episode of Peaky Blinders.
How long into it do you get before you're gone?
Oh, minutes.
And that's not to blame the programme. It's because you're the way you are. Yeah.
Like I love reading. Love reading. I'm dying to read Sophie White's new book. Can't read it.
Oh, no.
No.
Is it that bad?
Yeah.
So how can you be a mum to your kids then as well? Because if that's out, how's parenting?
So I take controlled naps. So set my alarm for 20 minutes, give myself a nap, and then that gets me through like 2 hours.
You'll have a run at it then with the kids.
And
the
just keep moving and keep concentrating. So certain people have triggers. It's not that Hollywood style fall asleep in your cornflakes or fall asleep like head down in the dinner table. For me anyway, it's not.
Do you think
that
representation, that there is a sense that there's a kind of taking the mickey?
Absolutely.
Do you
and
see
I
that?
Was and I was one of them people.
What do you mean?
Like I used to joke to my fiance all the time. We'd be watching something and he'd fall asleep and I'd be like, "Do you have narcolepsy?" I'm not even joking. Like I would always say that to him, and that's what I thought. I was so ignorant to what it actually is. And I never knew about cataplexy, and that to me is the worst
part
of it.
What is that? I've never heard of that.
So cataplexy is when my body goes into paralysis. So basically, when you're in REM sleep, your body is paralyzed to stop you acting out your dreams. When I'm awake, that happens to me. My body just goes into paralysis, and I fall.
You fall.
And I injure myself.
For example, sitting in before me, you seem really lively and, you know, upbeat and chipper and all the rest of it.
Yeah, I'm very heavily medicated.
Are you?
Yeah.
Are you really? Mm-hmm. And did you have to go the extra mile because you were coming on the radio or?
No, you see, I'm still, it's very early days, so I'm still not even on full dose yet.
So have you been diagnosed then?
Yes, officially diagnosed
in July. As narcoleptic and?
Type 1 narcolepsy with cataplexy is my diagnosis.
And is that something, is it curable?
No, it is not. It's so little is still known about it. And I got it, like my symptoms came on so fast. It takes 7 years for people to get diagnosed or to go from feeling a little bit tired to where I went to in a couple of weeks. Not curable, but very treatable.
Okay.
With the right diagnosis.
And do you feel the medication has got you into the place you need to be?
I can leave my house now. I wasn't leaving my house before.
And you weren't leaving your house because I presume you're afraid of falling.
And yeah.
I would imagine it knocks your confidence, does it?
Absolutely. Like talking to people, just having conversations and suddenly like your head drops, your speech slurs. Like there is a perception out there that I'm drunk. And imagine seeing a woman walking or trying to do her shopping with two kids and you're seeing her slur her words.
Or weaving in and out.
Or my knees just suddenly buckling while I'm trying to push a trolley. Like there is that perception that, okay, that woman at 2 o'clock in the afternoon is taking care of two babies, essentially drunk.
But that's gone now, that type of thing, is it?
Like
the nodding off or this.
It's not gone. The medication gets you like 80% there.
Yeah.
Sometimes stressful situations can push you over the edge. Like maybe if you're sick, like if you get a cold, your symptoms could kind of come back. Like it's never gone. Like you live with it every day and you learn to manage it and learn to manage your triggers. It's all about now me finding exactly what triggers me.
And what's triggering these days?
Like, so say, it's going to sound so ridiculous. Whenever my one-year-old was learning to walk, every time you take a few steps, I'd be so, oh my God, you're walking. And then I'd have an attack because I was so happy that he's walking. Or do you know, whenever...
Isn't that it's kind of weirdly ironic?
Yeah, I know. Or my toddler, or Logan, he started preschool this year.
Yes.
And on the Friday was the first day he went in happy without asking me to stay. And I was just so happy that he was sitting there with friends settled that I had an narcolepsy attack, attack in
you,
his school.
You need to be less happy.
Apparently so.
you need to watch really sad things.
But it's not just that really sad things get me too. I had to stop watching Game of Thrones because it was too exciting.
Come on. Like, really?
Yes. Like, I could, honestly, when I was unmedicated, I couldn't get through an episode of Game of Thrones.
And now, did you finish it in the end?
No. Haven't got back to it yet.
If the meds are right now, you should be able to finish it.
I'm still falling asleep, though.
Yeah, are you?
Yeah.
Okay. I mentioned your husband, but you're due to get married. You mentioned fiancé in November 2020. So that's another little while ago, 12 months time. So, you know, you're excited, you presume, about life and the future.
Yeah.
Are you? No, that wasn't very convincing. I'm
excited about life and the future. I'm nervous about the wedding.
Oh, the wedding. I thought you were going to talk to me about a medical nervousness. But when you say you're nervous about the wedding, is it the bigness of it or are you thinking about the narcolepsy?
Well, where do you schedule naps on your wedding day? Like between I do and the speeches?
Well, you're an expert at scheduling these naps now, so you'll know what to do.
Like, weddings are emotional, so I'm going to be saying my vows but falling to the floor in a dress. Like, do you know?
Just have a seat on standby. Have a throne on standby. You'll get through it. Don't worry yourself into a state because it's going to be beautiful and everyone will know that they need to mind you a little bit and it'll be grand.
Yeah, okay, we'll see.
You'll have no trouble at all. Do you feel that it's liberating to talk about it publicly?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because I didn't know, I knew so little about it, I'm finding loads of people don't know about it. And in the beginning, when people would say, are you drunk, epilepsy, this, that and the other, I'd kind of just be like, yeah, because when you say narcolepsy with cataplexy, it's like, well, what is that? And then it's like
you're
a 20-minute explanation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But now I'm telling everyone because it's something that needs to be talked about.
It's World Narcolepsy Day
this Sunday.
With three events all happening in Bray and Cork and Sligo, narcolepsyireland.org. So this is a thing.
It is.
And it's a thing that's been discussed by people like you, Naomi, who come on and give us your time. And also to make people like me and hopefully the listeners a lot more, excuse me, I keep calling you Naomi. It's Christine, my apologies. I've got my head a bit all over the place after the ploughing. Sorry, Christine. With people like me who don't know enough about it and need to know a bit about it so that we can then explain, or at least when we see somebody even in the shop, take a breath and say, hang on, maybe it's not as what it all appears at first. That's the point of it all. And are you part of a group as well?
So whenever narcolepsy came up, I contacted Narcolepsy Ireland. It's a very new charity set up and they were so helpful in just someone to vent to tell me that my symptoms were actually legitimate things, other people experience it, and most of all that there is help there.
Yeah.
Like 1 in 2,000 people in Ireland have it, but it's so misdiagnosed because doctors don't know enough.
Yes.
Like the HSE really need to put funding into educating doctors at primary care level so that they don't have to repeatedly go to A&E and beg for help.
And try and sort
it out. I feel so let down, and I'm not the only one. Everyone out there has had some story about how they were let down in their diagnosis.
And do you feel that you're in a better place now? Having found your way through the jungle, as it were.
Definitely. Yeah. Like, that's like, I wouldn't leave my house before medication. Like, I was so afraid to go do anything.
It's an amazing story, as the text says. It's shocking to know how little is known about narcolepsy and how long it took medical help, but very brave of Christine to share her story this morning. Yeah, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having
me. Here's to the great wedding.
Thank you.
Here's to the boys.
Yeah.
And here's to you finishing Game of Thrones.
One day.
All of the above. Christine Beck, thanks for coming in to see us this morning. Can't wish you enough good fortune in the future and appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
All right, it's 6 minutes to 10. 26 minutes past 9 this Thursday morning, and I'm delighted to say we're joined by our dear friend Cecilia Hearn. Good morning, Cecilia.
Good morning, Mr. Hobbity.
Well, you'll have to explain that.
Well, in our house, you are Hobbity. Ryan Hobbity, yeah.
Just
because Hobbity. My kids call you Ryan Hobbity, so that's what I now call you forever.
You did something very sweet. Well, not you. It had nothing to do with you. It was your daughter, Robin, did something very sweet as you reached into your bag and when I greeted you this morning, and you did what?
Oh, well, she wanted to give you your favourite sweets, which she told me were jelly babies.
She's so right.
she right?
She's 100% right.
Oh, fantastic.
Oftentimes, people very kindly give me jelly beans.
Get it wrong.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not jelly beans. You've got to get
She'll be chuffed.
So she got this bag of jelly babies. So
but you're not opening them, I noticed.
Not yet. I'm saving. I'll have to have coffee first, jelly beans later. Jelly babies. But thank you. And I'd love to do a little message for her to say thank you. Congratulations on the latest book that you promised you'd never write. I think this is really interesting about this.
Yeah.
P.S. I Love You was the phenomenon among all your other multi-million selling books and so on. But you did say that you weren't going to go there again. What happened?
I said I'd never do it from the beginning. From the moment I wrote P.S. I Love You, people were asking if I'd write a sequel. And there were just so many reasons why I wouldn't. First, it was I had brought the character to exactly where I wanted to bring her. Yeah. I couldn't see, like, what am I going to do? Bring Jerry back alive again? What, you know, I couldn't see what the story would be. And also, just because something's a success, I don't think that you should, you know, necessarily write a sequel. So, and also, I didn't want, you know, the thing that made my career to also be the thing that breaks my career. Well, so there's that.
Therein lies the rub as well. Yeah. But I was thinking about this today, that, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle killed Holmes, killed Sherlock Holmes, and said, Reichenbachfall, get rid of him. I'm sick. I'm kind of sick of him. One trick pony. I want to do something else.
Yeah.
And the people said, no, just keep singing the same song. Like, we want more Holmes. And he had to kind of I don't think that's the same story for you, obviously. But
I think, well, I think if the story, if there's a story, if the story is there, then you have to tell it. And I talk about all the millions of reasons why I didn't want to write it. But the one reason why I did is because I came up with an idea for a story and it just wouldn't go away. And it kept growing and growing and growing. And I thought, I have to write this. And what was really important to me was that it was a strong, that it could be a strong standalone novel, that regardless of whether people had read P.S. I Love You or not, that this would be strong enough to be a story
come
in itself.
As a newcomer to the story,
exactly,
as it were.
Yeah.
And you did, what was the trigger for the, there was a moment, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was a moment. So, and back in 2012, when I had my second baby, I was with my solicitor changing my will. You know, you're adding guardianship if anything happens to me.
Yeah, kind of morbid pastime, but
quite
yes.
Quite morbid, but necessary, you know? And if anything happens to me, who will take my children? And as I was doing that, I thought about all the things that people do in preparation for the possibility that they will leave this world, for the people that they're leaving behind. And I felt, well, P.S. I Love You was about, from the perspective of the person who's grieving, the people who are left behind.
Of course.
And I wanted to tell the story from a new perspective, from the people who've been told they're either terminally ill or they have life-altering conditions. And so Postscript is about a group of people who discover.
It's kind of like an odd fan club.
Yeah, an odd, they're called the P.S. I Love You Club. Yeah. Who've been inspired by Holly's experience and they ask her to help them write their letters for their loved ones.
Can I go back to the will for a second? I'm sorry, because I know it sounds more, but since you've become a mum, do you fear death more?
I suppose, yeah, because you're leaving. Yeah, it's horrible to even talk about, isn't it?
Yeah,
so that's why I wrote a book about it.
It crosses my mind every so often, and I tried to run away from the thought immediately.
Yeah, it's awful. But when my babies were babies, before I flew away for work or anything, which was always really difficult to do when you're leaving them, because I used to write a letter to them, and I'd write a little
handwritten
note,
letter.
Yeah, a handwritten letter of all the things I'd want, you know, them to know when they grow up that I didn't have the opportunity to say to them. So, or that I said to them, but they wouldn't remember. And actually, I did put that into the book. Mm-hmm. I added that as something that one of the characters does. Mm. And my mom told me that she did that for me as well. If she rarely went away, but if she went away on a holiday, she wrote a little note and kept it in her bedside locker for us to read.
What
in
a
case
gorgeous
happened.
Thing to do, and but also kind of a kind of pessimistic approach to traveling.
But it's,
if this plane goes down,
it's
at least it's serious prep.
It's prep. And that's what I've learned. That's what I've learned since P.S. I Love You. You know, the amount of people who've contacted me and told me about similar stories, like, not inspired by the book, but things that people have done themselves. That we do want to control. We can't control how we leave this world, but we know that we're going to. So at least we can control how, you know, the message we leave behind or, you know, and the state of the things that we leave behind. So that's really what I wanted to write about in this book, how you can control the life that you have while you're here.
I think one of the things as you're talking that you can control is to leave the people who you love like no other in no doubt of how loved they were by you. And you won't be around to tell them that.
Mm.
But if they have that sort of emotional legacy in their heart, what I call the hard drive, that they can access that memory or that thing or that expression, or that's probably what we're doing when we say, when you write those letters. Or
And also, when I was actually writing this novel, I went into it a bit more, and that Holly always felt that Jerry wrote those letters for her.
Mm-hmm.
But the more she analyses it, the more she realizes that, well, actually, he didn't want to be forgotten. There's also an element of remember me.
Yeah. And she's in love again. I mean, not to give too much away, but she has moved on.
She has moved on.
In that regard. Yeah. And that's an interesting thing to have to write about. Did you talk to people who found themselves you know, as a widow or widower, or did you just imagine it from scratch?
I imagined it from scratch, but I have spent the last 15 years really speaking about this with people
around the world.
Yeah. People who have been huge fans of PS I Love You. So obviously that came from imagination.
Of course it did, yeah.
But then letters and contact with people over the years has
informs your
definitely. And I remember one of the very first stories somebody told me when I was in San Francisco on one of my first tours in a bookstore. She told me that her father had passed away in the summertime, and at Christmas she went up to her attic to take out the Christmas decorations, and she found a box of presents that had been wrapped and labelled for each member of the family that he had arranged, you know, 6 months previously,
knowing
that he would pass away. And I actually did also, I put that in the book too, because I wanted to honour the very first story that I'd heard, my first PS I Love You story.
Yeah.
So, and I've heard so many stories like that. So that's kind of was enough research as well for
and
this.
Because you travel so, in the last number of decade or so, you've been travelling to so many corners of the globe. Do you find that, particularly in response to PS I Love You and feeding into Postscript, the new book, that the language of romance, love and indeed death is universal?
Absolutely. I mean, when people say, why was your book so successful? I mean, it's an impossible question to ask. I always say, ask the reader, because they're the ones who decide whether they like it or not. But I think it's because I'm writing about something that is so universal. We all know what it's like to fall in love. We all know what it's like. We're going to have to lose somebody and grieve. And it is such a universal emotion, feeling.
Yeah, of course.
And I think that's, and I wrote, I suppose I've written PS and Postscript with hope, you know?
Yes.
And that's what we want.
You when you tweeted in July the 4th as it happens, you sent out a tweet that suggested that this was grueling for you. I get the sense reading that you said that novel 18 has been nothing short of a marathon through uncharted brain terrain. It's a great word, great expression. I'm pooped. Pen drop. What was it about this one that was such a slog?
Well, that wasn't this. It was the one I wrote after this.
Oh, it was the one after. Oh, so, I'm so sorry. Yes, I misread that. I thought it was the... So what's the one after?
the one after will be out next year. But it was... No, to be honest, this was
You don't want to talk about the one after when you're trying to talk about the one. That's part
no
that
No one
for
wants
the moment.
To hear about that
All
one.
All right, okay. But it sounds like it...
But this was very... This was probably the most challenging book
was
I've
it?
Ever written, because I had to kind of do a study of my own book. I mean, I had to go back and read P.S. I Love You. It had been a long time. I had to find the holes in the story. You know, where are the holes that I can fill in for Postscript? Where are the seeds that I planted that can grow in the sequel? Like, which characters am I keeping?
So were you reading the P.S. I Love You with almost like with the red pen going, here, fix, address, sort out?
And there were things that I didn't explain, you know, I didn't explain why he wrote that letter. And I'm like, yes, that's great. Now I can bring that into the second one.
Great.
So it was really interesting. And I also wasn't able to build a character from scratch, which is what I love doing. You know, it's a character that I wrote 17 years ago as a 21-year-old, and it was my first novel. So I was thinking, what can I add to her now? How can I make her meaty and juicy and exciting for me as the writer that I am now? So it was just challenging, you know, in a very different way. And the reason why I chose 7 years later, so this is 7 years since Jerry passed away and 6 years since she read the last letter, because there is this seven-year theory, you know, that we are... You know, mind and body kind of evolve or change after every 7 years and become a kind of different version of ourselves. So I thought, well, I can't completely change Holly, but I can take on the new the new version of
like
Holly.
Like a gear change in her life.
Exactly,
absolutely.
Yeah,
I totally understand that. Amy Huberman's reading this book as your audiobook.
Yes.
Was she your first choice?
Oh, she's a fabulous.
Yeah, she's a friend of yours, I take it.
Yes, absolutely. And she's so talented.
I have a little sample of her reading from the book, which I'd like to hear. Okay, this is Postscript.
We're sitting in the window of her vintage and secondhand shop, Magpie, where I've worked with Keir for the past 3 years. Once again, we've transformed the shop to an event space where her podcast, How to Talk About, will be recorded in front of an audience. Tonight, however, I'm not in my usual safe place.
That's Amy Huberman reading a little bit of Postscript. Perfect casting, as I said to you there during
that.
I mentioned Celine Dion this morning because she's in the papers as saying she really misses her husband. She misses being touched and being hugged by somebody.
Yeah.
And it kind of resonates a little bit with your stories, both the previous and the current one. And Betty was on to say that she agreed with Celine Dion. It's the hugs and kisses and being special to someone that you miss. My husband passed away 6 years a go, and she's thinking about him as a result of the chat about it. And somebody else saying, listening to that, missing the wonderful feeling of another's touch. My husband died 10 years ago and it's still one of the things I really miss, along with the wonderful hugs. On a funnier note, having someone to zip up your dress when getting dressed.
Oh, yes.
You know? Yeah. And I spoke to, I remember I was speaking to Patricia Gibney, who I'm sure you've met on the circuit. I don't know, she's a crime writer. And she talks about how her husband died in real life, if I may use the expression. And she used to put the Argos catalogue on the bed beside her just to feel the weight.
Oh my gosh.
You know, because it's wow. These are the things that
aren't great. I love hearing those little things.
Aren't they the touches? Yeah. They're not greatly discussed, but they're worth airing, because people like to talk about these things.
And I know, and it is the little things. I remember people saying to me, it's, you know, when their husband passed away, they didn't know the password for the Sky code
For
the, you know, and all these little things that, you know, you don't know what the other does really every day until they're gone and you realise, oh gosh, they do the bins or they do. And it's all these little parts of them that you miss, like obviously the big parts of them as well.
Yes.
But it's the small things that stop you in your tracks, I think, every day.
They build.
Yeah.
When you wrote beans on toast and a bottle of beer... your great
the phenomenal
the great unpublished
debut.
First novel at the age of 14. I mean, when you wrote that, was it, obviously you were in school.
Yeah.
Was it a project or was this your a sidebar project at home that
it
you were...
was just I taught myself how to type on a Mavis Beacon typing course on the computer.
Clunk, 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 clunk.
And I just loved that typey 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 tappy feeling of being a writer, and I loved writing, so I typed up this book myself. It was all for me, and it was about a 16-year-old.
Yes.
So it was quite mature, older character.
She loved a boy who didn't love her back.
Yeah.
Parents got on her nerves.
Yeah.
16-year-old.
Yeah, I think it was pretty much
gold.
A diary.
Yeah. Based loosely on.
Yes.
Do you still have that?
I do,
oh,
actually.
Really?
I even illustrated my cover, which was like a really bad
Would
sketch.
You please tweet that later on for us?
I'll have to find it, yeah.
Fine,
yeah.
Dig it out. Because yeah. Your kids would love to see that.
I know.
So you've got Robin and...
Sunny.
Sunny. Robin being 9 now.
Yes,
and
that's
Sunny
right.
Being...
7.
7 and in 3 weeks' time.
Yes, new baby. Be on the way.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So 9, 7 and 0.
Yes.
How are you feeling about that?
Do you know what? It's really exciting and really different because I'm older.
How old are you now?
37.
Okay.
And it feels like we are having a baby. You know, the kids
the
are old
family.
Enough to understand. Yeah. And it's exciting. It really is.
Imagine
exciting.
Like Christmas in 3 years' time, particularly. It's just going to be a buzz.
It's brilliant. Look, life is never boring.
That's for sure. And so Robin and Sonny are prepared for this. They're going, okay, there's a new sheriff in
Oh, they're
town.
So excited. Yeah, they're taking it really well.
Do you have everything? Do you have all the gear?
We had to get everything
again. I was
going
to say, because you know the way sometimes you keep this stuff.
We had nothing.
Had you passed it all on to family and friends?
It was gone. Everything was gone.
That's so
I think
funny.
We have one high chair like hidden by Halloween and Christmas decorations that probably has a 7-year-old rice cake hidden in the cracks of it and, you know, squishy, mushed carrots somewhere. So I might take that out of the darkness and see if it still
Dust
works.
Dust it down. There'll be a lot of spiders on it this time of year, so watch that.
There'll be things growing on it.
Love, hate, right? You loved The Time Traveller's Wife as one of your all-time favourites.
Yeah, I do love that book, yeah.
But I'm intrigued by the... Well, hate's too strong, but tell me about your frosty relationship with Jane Austen. You're not a fan.
I'm not a fan.
What is it about her? Just hard work.
Yeah, I just find it. I can't really connect to it. It's a time gone that I can't identify with. I find it irritating.
Is it just the?
It's the
all of it.
Yeah, it's not a modern woman, and that really just frustrates me to go back in time to where people can't say what they want to say. I'm just like, say it, spit it out. You know, this language where
it's like the 80s in Ireland.
true. Yeah, I suppose I don't like all that.
Yeah.
There's a word for it.
I'm not sure quite what the word might be at this moment.
You know what I mean.
But would you watch things like, would you watch all the old Pride and Prejudice?
No, see, I don't like all that old worldy stuff. But I do love The Crown, actually.
Do you?
Bizarrely.
Well, that's probably closer to our time than that time, if you know what I'm saying.
See, that's how much I know about it.
That's how much you know.
Yeah, no, I'm not an old worldy person. I think I just get irritated by people not being able to say what they want to say and
there's
games and...
Yeah. You're just trying to spit it out and sort it out.
Yeah, spit it out and be honest.
Just a quote that you said once about being successful. And this could be old. Mm. And I wonder, has it changed since you said it? Everyone wants you to explain your success. And you said, if I was the son of a politician, I'm pretty sure it would be different. And I'm not having a pop at the politician thing. It's just, do you think that there's a gender issue there, or has that been addressed in recent times?
I think it's been addressed. Yeah. So I don't want to be one of those people that go on about it. But I just one of the fascinations kind of with my career was how much I made and the size of the first deal and all of that. And I always used to think I'd look at footballers who were getting like 20 gazillion a week and they never apologize for it, never have to explain why or you know, is it their own natural talent or, you know, so there was a lot of that. I think I was probably just comparing, having one of those days where I was comparing.
But I wonder, like, is it different also in the UK if somebody's making all that money as a footballer or whatever, they kind of go, well, that's what you do if you play for Man United. Whereas here it's kind of, now Cecilia Hearn, I knew her when she had nothing and now she's there with all that money.
Well, you know, it's a good thing about Ireland. We will be kept grounded.
For sure.
Yeah.
Obviously, P.S. I Love You was a hugely successful movie, yes. Cecilia. And there's a little bit of news, I understand, in the pipeline that you are revealing exclusively and for the first time on the planet Earth here on our radio show, which we are honoured to know about. So,
for the first time, Mr. Hoppity.
Yes, ma'am.
There will be a postscript movie.
Congratulations. Yay. This is huge.
It is great.
Already, like.
Do you know who emailed? One of the first people to email me when we announced the news was Hilary Swank. She was so excited. She wanted to read the book and she said, I would love to support you in any way, shape or form. And then she read the book and she said, I want to make this movie. So at that stage, we'd already kind of, everyone who was involved in the first
The old gang are back.
Yeah, but really, it felt like a lovely reunion, everyone back together again. Now we don't have screenwriter, director or any of that.
Nothing's
been announced yet.
Yeah. Well, it has now.
But the movie's happening.
And Hilary Swank back for...
Yeah,
that's great.
Back.
So having to kind of do that weird recasting of the...
Exactly.
Yeah. Congratulations.
I'm delighted.
That's a busy time for you. It's always a busy time for you. Yeah. Have you had a book every year since, you started?
Yeah.
You're incredible, honest to goodness. Maria's in Cork. She says, Cecilia, you're amazing. My daughter, Abby, is 13, loves reading and tells me she's going to be an author. And I keep telling her that she will. She had an amazing imagination and you are her inspiration.
Wisers.
I love hearing that, especially the youngsters. It's just tremendous. Una's in Sligo. She said, I have a notebook for my two children. And I write in it every birthday and Christmas. I don't have time for a diary, so it helps to capture precious memories. And Frank says, I'm enjoying the interview with Cecilia. My life is short. It's a mystery, but our ability to love and to be loved gives me hope that we will live on in spirit. So that's a nice way to conclude our chat this morning. Cecilia, congratulations. Postscript is the book. I know you're also doing an event at the beautiful Stella Cinema in Rathmines on Saturday, September the 21st, where it'll be a question and answer session with you.
Yes, so you can watch the movie. You can watch P.S. I Love You and then we'll talk about Postscript.
And book signings afterwards, which is pretty exciting. So people can find that, no doubt, online for details on that. So well done. But in the meantime, good luck. I think particularly with child number three, just the latest book. I think that's just they're the most important productions of them all, as you know. So I'm delighted for you and congratulations.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming in. And now I need to do a message for Robin to say thank you for the jelly babies.
Thank you so much.
Job done. Cecilia Hearn joining us live on the programme this morning. The time is a quarter to 10. Well, he is the presenter of one of the biggest television shows on the planet, but like any self-respecting television host, he has also turned his hand to writing children's books, and fine books they are too. Dermot O'Leary, good morning.
Hey, Ryan.
So much
nice
to...
talking to you.
Likewise.
I missed you.
But it's been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the last time we were just short of having an Irish Cayley in together with the whole lobby being washed down.
Yeah. That was great.
Was that not surreal for you?
Yeah, really weird. Brendan Shine.
Brendan Shine.
Oh, I love
Dermot
Brendan
O'Leary
Shine.
Together at last.
He looks exactly the same as he did. Yeah. I had two pictures. I had one of him with a blue roll neck and one of him with a beige roll neck when I was a kid. Both signed. My dad got signed. And he looks exactly... He's still going.
Yeah, he's going fine. And, you know, the Irish music scene, do you keep an eye on it? Even now, whether it's recent past or currently, do you kind of...
So I had the good fortune to have a few people in session, and then I'm patron of the London Irish Centre over in Camden.
Oh, yes, of course.
And so we did a great gig last year to kind of kick off the big refurb we want to do up there. Mm. Because it's an incredible place, both culturally and what it does in the sort of the local community.
Yes.
And we kicked off with Ed Sheeran, who's brilliant, and Ed's sort of, you know, almost one generation down from me. So yeah, his grandparents are Irish as opposed to his parents. So he feels very connected, as I'm sure you know, with the whole kind of, you know,
his granny and the whole lot. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so Ed did a big fundraiser for us last year, and we're doing another one next year. So next week, so we've got Imelda May, Foy Vance, we have Maverick Sabre to name but three. They're going to come on. I'll do an interview, and then I'll do one of their own songs, and then I'll do a folk or Americana song. And then I was on Maverick Sabre's Instagram account, and he, I forget the kid's name now, but he was really good. And he's kind of a grime artist, but from New Ross, which I know kind of sounds like an oxymoron.
Wexford, no.
But you know, really good.
Yeah, well, it's just so good that you're doing that there in London, particularly with the Irish Centre and promoting all these.
Oh, it's a great place.
It's
honestly
a great. Why do you do that? I mean, why do you feel, not the need, but the inclination to get so involved?
Well, I suppose it's identity, isn't it? I think you choose your identity, I think, quite young in your life. And I think when you're a teenager, you're searching for what makes you different. And what's different always appealed to me, I think. And being, you know, I know it's hardly unique, but being Irish and to a degree being Catholic over here was quite unusual. Certainly outside London, northwest London, obviously, it was. You know, it's probably the norm. But where I grew up, which is about 60 miles outside London, and every second weekend we'd spend in London. So I had this kind of almost supercharged version of it. You know, as every kind of sort of child of immigrants has, you have that kind of condensed, you know, idea of nationality. But my parents were great because they never forced anything on me. So therefore, and also it was culturally, it became very enticing because at the time, you know, when I got to a very formative age, the Pogues released If I Should Fall From Grace With God. And that was kind of the definitive album for me, one of the definitive albums for me growing up. So the music was there, the literature was there, and it all became a very authentic. And so we didn't have to try too hard because it was every time I shut the door and came home, it was what was in front of me. I sort of,
you could immerse.
You grow up in an Irish house. And what's really interesting is when I speak to my mates who are second generation Afro-Caribbean, West Indian, Sri Lankan Indian, they have exactly the same experience.
Yeah, it's a healthy thing. I mean, that I often think that's
hugely.
For particularly for children who come to are now what we call the new Irish, in here, that you can spin two plates culturally. You can have the home country and the new country. It's very possible.
But it's amazing how many people don't think it's possible.
Well, that's for sure, and they're here too.
Life.
By the way, yeah.
It's, you know, that's the world, and it's been the world for the fact that the world's smaller now. Is the only difference. It's been the world for hundreds of years.
And no question about it. Just as you were talking about the music and the Pogues there, Sinead O'Connor was with us on the Late Late recently and she sang.
Well, I wanted to speak to you about it because I got in from a night, so I was emotionally already slightly vulnerable when I watched it. and then she did Rainy Night in Soho, which I love, but the Nothing Compares to You was absolutely heart-stopping. And then at the end, when she knew the song, when she nailed the song, and she just looked at camera and smiled and waved. And it just, honestly, Ryan, it broke my heart.
I punched the air.
What was it like to be there?
I punched the air. I was so happy for her. I felt like I was watching, you know, a boxer in a ring. And a boxer like a Rocky 7, you know. I felt like she made the few movies. We'd seen her. We'd been on the ground with her on the canvas. We'd been up again. We'd been against the ropes. And then it felt like she'd come back and she'd knocked it out of the park.
Because you must have interviewed her a fair few times down the years, right? But you must have seen, I know, do you know what? It's interesting. Because I watch your stuff a lot online. And it reminded me of the Stephen James Smith, This Community in the Albert Hall, which just was another one of those.
Yes.
I've watched it time and time again.
The poet,
And that about the Irish in Britain. And that was, and you know, it's the moment that, and I urge any of your listeners now to just go online after you've finished hearing Ryan. go online and watch that because it's that moment where he realises he's in the Albert Hall. He's still like on an organ or something. And he breathes in. It's that breath in where he, and then he just goes for it. And similarly with her, Yeah. It's when she was wagging her finger too. I went to the doctor and guess what he told me? I love it when you see an artist so immersed in what they're doing. It's beautiful.
Remember she lifted herself off the floor, jumped at one point.
Yeah,
said, look
yeah.
at that, bang, we're here. You know, we're yeah. in. And you know, it's funny you should mention not the Royal Albert Hall, but at least the show we did in London and you talking about the Irish Centre. And I'm going to mention it now, even though it'll probably give you an ulcer, but Brexit.
I'm now sat in a studio in London, so every time I'm looking out the window, there's just ulcers everywhere.
Everywhere.
We've all got ulcers over here.
I can imagine the palpitation. So we won't dwell on it too much, but I suppose the difference in our conversation to the one that you might have in Waitrose with a stranger is that it seems to be having an effect of some description, Dermot, on the Anglo-Irish relationship, if you want to call it that. There's just something a little fractious, unhelpful, maybe.
Yeah, I think after sort of so many years of positivity,
yes,
it does feel like it's a kind of retrograde step. And I think Varag has done a kind of very good job in his diplomacy, I'm honest with you.
Yes.
And I think I wish that could kind of be mirrored over here, because you never want, I mean, both certainly literally, but also the way people speak to each other, you never want to go back to
that kind of ugliness.
And listen, you know, it'll sort itself out one way or the other, but I studied politics at A level and then at university, and I was no expert in our weird hodgepodge constitution, but I thought I had it in my head as to what was going to happen 6 months ago. Yeah. And now I'm fascinated by it. Every single day you wake up and it's off the map. The one good thing that's come from it, and it is, trust me, in my opinion, it's the one good thing, mm-hmm. is that people are engaged in politics.
Yep,
now,
I agree with you.
It's brought out the you know, some dark shadows in our society, mm-hmm. that I'd rather weren't there. But, and that's a bad thing, but it's at least it's engaged, especially young people, in what matters to them.
Yeah, and they're up, even if it's things like the global climate change. You know, been led
absolutely.
By children, which is intriguing. One of the films that just leapt. We had Christy Dignam from Aslan on last week, and he sang Waltzing Matilda, right? And the reason he sang, we had met during the week, and we were talking about what song he might sing, and he mentioned that one. And it talks about 1916, but it refers to 1916, the call up for World War One of Irish men, and as opposed to 1916, the rising.
Yeah.
For years and years, decades, we didn't really celebrate the fallen soldiers in 1916. You get the point of the story. And where I'm going with this is a film that you loved, which is They Shall Not Grow Old.
Oh yeah.
Which breathed life and colour into what could be the Kansas of history and turned it into something marvellous and just brought it into hopefully a new generation. I mean, your love of history, it's important, isn't it, for kids to see things like that?
Hugely. I mean, that Springsteen biography at the moment, and he talks about, you know, history matters in the songs we sing, and it just translates to everything. I think there's so much to be learnt from it and pay homage to it, and just, you know, it kind of, you do, when you learn through history, you kind of understand where you are, and actually 100 years in historical terms is the blink of an eye. I remember I watched that film, and I watched it on a plane because I had it there waiting for me at home, and it never felt like the right time to watch it. And I was on a plane to America earlier on, and you know how when you do long haul travel, especially, you slightly get a bit more emotional in what you watch and how you react. And I'd had a couple of glasses of wine, and apropos of nothing, Kirsty Young was sat two seats away from me.
Okay.
She saw me watching it, and she walked past me and went, "What on earth are you watching that on the plane for?" And I looked up to it, with tears streaming down my face, going, "I know, I don't know what I was thinking. I just thought, because I'm a captive audience, so I can properly concentrate on it without any other distractions."
It's so
Big
true.
Mistake.
It's so true. I had a similar experience with The Colour Purple, but that's for another day.
I bet.
No, but of all the films, like, what made me watch The Colour Purple? Anyway, I see where you're coming from. I wouldn't have had you out, Dermot, as a cat guy, but I know, I just want to talk about your kids' book. book because they're gorgeous and they're important because anything that gets kids reading is magnificent. This is your third.
Hugely, yeah.
So why did you... Have you always been a cat guy? Or?
Well, I'm. No, from honest, I always thought I was going to get a dog when I was a kid. My mum and dad, in a, they made me move. They sort of kidded me into moving house and it'd be okay that I love my the house I grew up in under the auspices of... You can get a dog when we move house, and then they reneged on the promise.
Yes,
and I've never let them forgive. I've never forgiven them for it. And yet, so we were going to get a dog the year we got cats, and my sister had cats. I've always loved cats. I've always loved how calming and relaxing they are.
Yes,
and now I've become fascinated with them. And don't get me wrong, I'm not like anti-dog. I love dogs as well. But I think the way my life works at the moment, cats are a perfect pet because you just, A, something that relaxes you when you come in, and also someone who's largely ambivalent to your presence when you come in is what I need. If nothing else, just a kind of memento mori moment where they go, what can I get? Who are you again? So we have a place in Italy and we've been going there years and we rent it out so it wipes its nose, and there's a great cat that was hanging around the villa, and she and one year she became pregnant, and I came back about a couple of days early, and then Dee, my wife, called me and just said she's having the kittens in our room in my pillowcase now. And so Dee stayed up all night and she had four kittens and helped to deliver these kittens, and that was kind of it. We just went, well, we're gonna keep two, and then the neighbors had two, so we brought them back. And then we realized quite early that Toto was almost, that one of our cats was almost 100% blind. She could see breaks in light, but she had great reactions. And so that's where the idea came from. And then we're three books down now. So now I've created this whole world where she's part of an ancient order of international cat ninjas who make sure that, who are placed with every world leader to make sure they don't do anything stupid. And she's Larry, the 10 Downing Street cat's kind of deputy.
Yes.
And she's had a couple of massive adventures, and now she's taken some time off. So she goes down to the annual Animal Music Festival of Catsonbury.
You must have had so much fun with the cat puns. Oh God, I'd love that.
The best. Yeah. Well, when Dee was starting out in television, she used to work with Emily Evis, who of course, Emily, her whole family run Glastonbury, and she runs Glastonbury, and so we know her quite well. And I emailed her earlier on when I was writing it, going, are you okay if I personification that you're an otter? And she was like, I love otters, not a problem. So otters run the festival.
Brilliant. I mean, it is great fun. And you brought a sidekick into Toto, the ninja cat, the superstar catastrophe. Were you in a few minds as to the wisdom of that, or does every Sherlock need a Watson?
She has two. She has a brother, Silver, who's kind of almost act as a kind of sidekick slash guide dog. But I also wanted to create a character, A, is a kind of nod to Victoriana London, which was always the kind of London I saw in films when I was a kid and was entranced by, and why I guess I fell in love with the city from a very early age. And B, I wanted this kind of inclusive character. So he's a rat who lives his life as a cat. He's rat royalty. He's from an old North London Jewish rat family who have been here since the 1600s, originally immigrated from Germany, and everyone knows him and everyone loves him. So he's this charm personified. He's kind of and he's a combination of Stephen Fry, Richard E. Grant, John Bercow, and my friend Ollie Brack, who's the most charming dinner companion you can imagine. So it's a combination of all those. And his name's Catface, and I wanted him to be kind of a personification of all the best of London.
I saw you saying not too long ago that you were worried about the ghost of Scrappy Doo haunting your... Now, people of our vintage will be going, not Scrappy Doo!
Exactly. Yeah. So we've adopted another cat from Battersea called Socks.
Yes.
And I just felt I'd duty bound to stick him in there. But I'm going to keep him very small and a bit part player. And I'm going to try and make sure he's not irritating.
Dermot, where is X Factor?
Where is it? Do you mean emotionally?
No. I did that very strange thing because I normally watch it with my girls on a Saturday, and it's kind of our go-to thing just to, in the early evening or what have you. And I did that thing where I Googled, where is X Factor?
Yeah, where is it now?
And it comes up really quickly as it kind of, it's turning into two shows. There's a superstar gang.
That's exactly
right.
What
is happening?
So we're doing a celeb version, which two episodes of which we've filmed already.
Okay.
Out in the States. And then we come back to the studio in October sometime, and then we go through for about 6 or 7 weeks, I think it is, I'm not sure, Yeah, so we're doing a celeb version, and then towards the end of the year, we're going to do an all-star version, which is bringing back all the winners and the nearly rans and the great characters of X Factor past, and just do a kind of old, like a good, great light entertainment celebration of kind of almost like your X Factor greatest hits, I suppose.
There may be twins from Ireland with extraordinary hair.
Maybe. Negotiations ongoing, I suppose. But yeah, I hope so. I said to them, if Jedward and Wagner doing it, because as long as Jedward and Wagner are doing it, you can book whoever you else want. I'm part of it.
That's so fun. I remember the actor, Gabriel Byrne was on the late one night, and as were Jedward. And I think Tony Blair. It was one of those completely bonkers nights.
That must have been wonderful.
And I remember because Jedward high-fiving Tony Blair, going, "Hi, guys, hi." You know, as they're going down the corridor thing, and Gabriel Byrne referred to them as the Jedward, which I think, it, you know, has a ring to it too.
The fact Gabriel Byrne even knew who Jedward were.
There's no avoiding them. There's no avoiding them. So it's all going so well for you, Dermot, in terms of, I mentioned the X Factor, of course, you're on BBC Radio 2, and you have the third of, I hope, of many books. How would you describe yourself? We're kind of the same age, I think, 46 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
How would you describe life at the moment for you?
You know, I've always been a cup half full person, I think, but life's I'm just really enjoying it. I'm doing the work I want to do, and I'm loving the work I'm doing. And that was always what I wanted to get into television. I wanted to be an actor when I was a kid, but I knew quite early doors I wasn't good enough. And then I got into TV, and I wasn't really sure what I'd do in telly. I really wanted to produce, but I always wanted to sort of give front of camera a go. And then I fell in love with radio as well. And so, yeah, look, I'm a very lucky guy, and I never take that for granted. I don't want to sound like a beauty queen, but I never take that for granted, in that I really enjoy my life and I enjoy my work, and I love interviewing. I think interviewing people is my favourite thing, and I'm sure you're the same.
I love it.
In that, you know, you're only in this job because you like people and you're interested in people. And when I meet kids, like, that are trying to get into the industry, that's the thing I say is the most important thing is be curious.
You're so right. Curiosity is, well, I was going to say curiosity killed the cat, but you don't want that. You have no books.
I hope not.
There's a question I wanted to ask you, Dermot, briefly about the X Factor thing. We had Greg and Maura and Curtis from Love Island on the first late back. They were big stars of that season. And I was asking them about that duty of care business that, you know, the X Factor. Sure. Yeah, because there's some people have come out of it really badly out of the X Factor experience. Not just the X Factor, I suppose Little Mix I'm thinking of a little bit, but that care, they were saying that they're on it now. The companies are minding them. This was important to you, I think. Was it behind the scenes?
Oh, very early doors, yeah. I mean, to be in the show's defence, I think the duty of, the issue you've got really is the duty of care on the show is, I think, has always been good, but invariably it's always been researchers. So as the show's evolved, you're asking kids in their 20s to do an awful lot. And actually, so now I think the fact we always have someone who's qualified to give care there, I think is really important. The issue we're always going to have on a show like The X Factor is that when those people leave the show, they leave the show. So you can look after them as best you can, but they then go out into the big wide world with music management, and then it's the music manager's responsibility to look after them, because it has to be, because the show can't look after people in perpetuity. So the most important thing for us is that they're well looked after while they're there. And I've always slept very well with that, because I've always felt we do a good job with that. I think what the interesting, and I think the Jesse Nilsson documentary was wonderful, and Jesse, I've always gotten very well with Jesse, and I've always admired her greatly.
And just to remind people, Dermot, sorry to cut across, she was obviously a little bit, and she came across, she had an awful time with her mental health as a result, and the trolling and so forth.
And what's interesting is, and I don't think anyone could have realised, the genie in the bottle of social media.
Yes.
Because when you first, I mean, you know, you look back to someone like a band like One Direction, and they came around the same time as social media. They was kind of, the blueprint off the back of that was, well, it's so important to engage. And of course, actually, when you look at it on paper, the idea that you post a pretty picture or you say a few things and go, "Hey guys, we're going to be doing this, and I hope you enjoy this in 140 characters," seems very innocent, and it should be really at its base level. That's kind of what it is. But obviously, it's been hijacked down the line with the whole trolling thing. And I don't think anyone could have expected how kind of toxic and how corrosive social media has become. And of course, that's going to have an impact, especially of a generation who have brought up with social media being a norm in how they communicate, of course it's going to resonate, and of course it's going to have a detrimental impact. And that I think is that, from our point of view, from a TV show's point of view, it's how now we go about making sure that people are protected from that. Mm. And that's vitally, vitally important.
You evolve as a program with society.
Of course.
Parallel.
Yeah.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Dermot, listen, it's always great to talk to you, and you're just great at what you do, and I love what you're doing.
Thanks, Ryan.
I love that you fly the Irish flag as well as obviously the British flag, but you know, it's tremendous. And thanks for your time today. Congratulations.
Thanks, pal. Always lovely talking to you, Ryan.
Likewise. All right.
Take care.
Dermot O'Leary, his latest book, Toto, the Ninja Cat and the Superstar Catastrophe, is a must-have on the shelves of young people around the country, particularly if cat lovers in your life and you like adventure. It's tremendous. As is Dermot O'Leary joining us on the programme this morning. The text number, as always, 51551.